I mean, thanks, Mikey. Well,
it's great to be here. I've been in your beautiful city for the last 24 hours, and I tell you, I love it. I love it. It's such a great place to be, and I feel a great privilege to be here. I am from Melbourne. I grew up in Melbourne. I'm married. I've been married about 10 years. Have three children, five-year-old daughter, three-year-old son, and a one-and-a-half-year-old son named Jacob as well. And it's just a fantastic honor to be here and share on what is no doubt such a significant question, topic. It is significant because it's so relevant for us here. Relevant for everyone. It doesn't matter if you grew up going to church or, like me, never went to church for most of my life. The question of evil and the question of suffering is so relevant because suffering is not just something that we see, it's something that all of us in this room have experienced. To varying measures and to different degrees, all of us have our scars to show and our stories to share. Stories of heartache, stories of loss, stories of disappointment, of frustration, of anger. We all have those stories, and we're all trying to grapple with what to do with those stories and how to understand this world in the midst of those stories. I grew up in Melbourne, and for much of my life, I would say I experienced both the glory of this world, lots of great things about life, but also a bunch of garbage as well. Life growing up in Melbourne was great. I loved sport, got involved in a band, I had great mates at school, I loved competitive sport and a whole bunch of things like this. Lots to really enjoy about life, and I'm sure you can relate to that. And yet at the same time, there's elements out there that are challenging or hard to work out. My parents, they married when they were young. A lot of fights in the home. At times things got a little bit rough. It was always very tense. They divorced when I was probably about 9 years of age. That's a hard time as a kid growing up. My brother, who was older than me, was about 15, 16 at the time. He kind of spiraled from that point, ended up living on the streets, got in a whole bunch of gangs, did crime. I remember at the age of, actually in year seven, waking up to about 20 suited police officers who kind of rammed through our door and kind of ransacked the whole place looking for the stolen goods and drugs and turned the place all upside down. And I left that day wondering, I don't know if I'm going to see my brother again. Is he going to be behind bars? What's going to happen with that? There's challenging moments like that in life. My mum, who I lived with for much of my life, she was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was 18, just graduating from year 12. And she got through that. And yet at the same time, it was, as you would know, very challenging, very tough. A lot of loss in that. And it makes you question life, makes you question, you know, the reason, the purpose we're here and what to do with that. I think actually one of the most formative moments for my life was about 10 years ago. I used to actually work for World Vision, and I led a small group of students from around Australia, different parts of Australia, on a study tour to Cambodia. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with Cambodia's story or its history, but it is, man, it's dark and it's broken and it's a very challenging place to be. And on the very first day that we were there, I jumped on the back of a motorbike. We rode into the main city and this rubbish dump in a place called Phnom Penh. It's this really confronting place. I mean, literally 10 metres either side of rubbish. Just this kind of like this hallway of rubbish. And you kind of go on your way through, just wondering, and the stench is just so strong. It's palatable. You can taste it. And then you get in and you just see a sea of rubbish. And then you start to realize that amongst the sea of rubbish that's smoldering and there's ashes flying and it's the stench is so strong, you see people. Thousands of people, men, women, children. Men, women and children who live at this rubbish dump with their little Hessian bags just going around trying to find something, a bottle cap that they might be able to trade to get something to just get through the day. And after going that, we then journeyed to the killing fields. And there we are hearing about the millions of people who were killed, slaughtered, life taken from them. And the lady, the Cambodian lady who was doing this, sharing this and taking us on this tour began to weep. It was so real for her. The brokenness, the tragedy, the suffering. And I don't know about you, but in those moments, my heart cries out. And I'm sure you can relate to it. It cries out and says, there has to be another way. There has to be something better than this. These people, our life, there must be more. When we're in the midst of suffering, whether it's your suffering or a friend of yours who is suffering, there's parts of us that cry out for another way, a better way. Now, it could be that our longings for a better world are just wishful thinking. No real foundation. They're just there. If that's the case, we just need to push on through those moments. It could be, however, that those longings are actually more of a sign. They're actually pointing you to a reality that says actually what we're experiencing here and now, the evil, the suffering, isn't as it's intended to be. There is a new and better life for us to come. If so, how? What does that look like? And how do we get there? Those questions in mind, I wanted to share you just one story from the Bible. It comes in the Gospel of John. John was an eyewitness to the life of Jesus, and he sought to give a kind of a description, an eyewitness account of his life. And we encounter this story in John chapter 11. You've got a little handout there that kind of you can read that, and I encourage you actually to read it this week and to reflect on this. But I just want to highlight a few things about this story, because it's a story that talks about suffering and God's response to it. We read in this story that there's a guy named Lazarus and there's a guy named Jesus, and Lazarus is a friend of Jesus. And Lazarus has become sick. He's become ill. So ill, in fact, that his sisters, Mary and Martha, put a message out for help. And you can have a look at this in verse 3. This is the message that they put out. They say, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." Lord, he whom you love is ill. Why are they bringing this need to Jesus? They're bringing this need to Jesus because they've seen something in this Jesus that is unique. And maybe you're here today and you think that about. There's something about Jesus that has got your interest. You've heard perhaps about his miracles. You see a bit of what he has to say about truth. You can feel the compassion that he has. These women, they've come to know Jesus, and so they're calling out for him for help. "Jesus, could you help in this situation? Our brother is sick." And I'm sure you've been in that situation. That place of suffering, that place of need, and you've put out a message to help, of help. Maybe it was to a friend, maybe to a family member, or maybe even God. Maybe you called on Jesus. You said, "Jesus, could you help? Could you help in this moment?" That's what these women are doing. They're coming to Jesus with their need. And what would you expect Jesus to do? You'd expect him to respond, to do something immediately, to fix the situation, to end the suffering. Yet it's curious what happens next. Have a look at verse 5 and see what Jesus did. It says, "Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was." He stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. The sisters had put out a message because of their sick friend. And they're hoping for Jesus to do something. And yet Jesus chooses to stay there 2 more days. And so I want you to picture feel the emotion of these two sisters as they wait. Just waiting on Jesus. They've put the message out and here they are, they're waiting. I know I can relate to that. I know many here would relate to that feeling of waiting. You cry out to God, "God, I want you to do something here." And yet what we find ourselves is waiting. Waiting for God to respond. Waiting and thinking that God doesn't care. Here they are, they're waiting. That waiting is a hard place to be. It's a painful place to be. It's very easy to give up on God in those moments. And perhaps what is more staggering is that John reveals that while they're waiting, Lazarus, who was ill, dies. They've sat there with their sick friend Lazarus. They've called out for Jesus, and in the days of their waiting, Lazarus, who was ill, has died. This is a very gripping story. It's a very real story. I love that about the Bible. It's not afraid to talk about the hard things in life. Here they are, a sick friend has died, and Jesus hasn't shown up. I've sat by the bedside of a family member and watched them breathe their last. It's not easy. And you know that feeling. You know the feeling of waiting on Jesus, waiting on God to do something. And yet sometimes the situation goes from bad to worse. Now, we could talk about the reasons behind the waiting and why God does or doesn't turn up at the time we think he should. We could talk about that, and they're important questions, and I'd be happy to chat through with those questions. But I want to give you a message of hope. I want to give you a message of hope. Have a look, verse 17. Oh, in fact, even before that, have a look at how Jesus responds. You see, after the painful wait, after the 2 days, after everyone has given up, after Lazarus has died, Jesus arises and turns to his followers and says, "Let us go to Judea." In other words, let us see Lazarus. He makes a decision 2 days in to get up and go. Was there a season of waiting? Yes. Had Jesus given up? No. He hadn't given up. He had a purpose in mind. He had a plan. And though there is some waiting for us, he was always in control. He always knew exactly how things were going to turn out. And so he comes to Lazarus. Look to verse 17. It says this, "Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. In those days, it was believed that the spirit of a person departed from the body 3 days after they were dead. So what John is pointing out is that Lazarus is not just dead, he's dead, if there's such a thing. He's really dead. It's gone. It's over. It's finished. We've done the memorial service. We've said our goodbyes. Lazarus is dead. And so there's a lot of emotions. Can you imagine the frustration of Martha and Mary, the anger that they must have had? And they come out to Jesus, verse 21, "Lord, if you had have been there, my brother would not have died." Have you ever found yourself saying a similar thing? "God, if you had have turned up in this moment, things wouldn't be as bad as they are. God, why didn't you turn up? I called out for you. I put a message out and yet you didn't come. I've been waiting for you. It's too late." Martha shares her pain with Jesus. She does this honestly. In the same breath, she says, "But even now..." These are remarkable words. "Even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." It's John 11:22. "Even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." You know what we call that as a Christian? We call that faith. Faith is coming to Jesus in the midst of very hard circumstances, not just the good circumstances, very hard circumstances, saying, "You know what, even though everything looks over, even though everything looks finished and done, I put my trust in you." And she does that before Jesus because she sees Jesus as not just a good man or a moral teacher. She sees him as the God-man, the one who is able to bring light in the darkest of situations, the one who is about to bring life even in the midst of death, even now. Jesus said to her, verse 23, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he'll rise again in the resurrection on the last day." That's what she's thinking about there. Jesus says, no, hear me again. "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." Jesus makes this big, bold, and audacious claim about who he is. He's not there just to comfort, though he will comfort. He's not there just to give advice. He's there to declare who he is. The resurrection and the life, the source of life. The one who can give life, a life to be enjoyed here and now. A life to be enjoyed forever. And so he says, "Do you believe this?" He calls her to faith. It's one thing to trust in God when everything's smooth sailing, when everything's going wonderful. It's another thing to trust God when things are really hard, when you feel as everything is falling apart. Yeah, that's what Jesus calls for. "I'm the resurrection and the life. Believe me. Trust me. Don't give in. Don't let go. Trust in Jesus." He asks her, "Do you believe?" And she responds, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world." At this point, we're told that many more then join Jesus and the sisters, and there's weeping and there's crying, and Jesus himself weeps in the midst of the circumstance. Says, in fact, that he was greatly disturbed. And then he makes his way to the tomb. He rolls away the stone. And with a loud voice, note these words, he says, "Lazarus, come out." And John tells us the man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with cloth. And Jesus said to him, "Unbind him and let him go." Unbind him and let him go. Friends, this is a remarkable story. It's a remarkable event. We're talking about a person who was dead. And Jesus has come in when all hope had seemed lost. And with a few words, was able to bring life. What are we to make of this? I want to share with you three final observations and then a question. Three final observations and then a question. The first observation is this. Jesus not only knows our suffering, he is actually moved and disturbed by suffering. Jesus not only knows our suffering, he is moved and disturbed by suffering. When Jesus goes and sees Mary and Martha and his friend Lazarus, who's dead, 4 days dead in the tomb, John says he weeps. He knows how this story is going to end. And yet in the midst of their pain and suffering, he weeps. Some time back, I was in London and I went to see a theatre production of The Lion King. Has anyone seen The Lion King, the TV, the movie? It starts with this song, "The Circle of Life." And it's a theatre production. It's wonderful and it's joyful and it's colourful and everyone's singing it and it's exciting. And the Circle of Life is this song that has a principle that, you know, you're born and then you grow up and then eventually you kind of rot, decay and die. But it's all good because your body becomes food for another animal that'll eat that and it'll grow up and it'll decay eventually and die. But that's okay because it's a circle of life and we're all singing and dancing and it's Hakuna Matata and this is a happy free philosophy and we're loving it and this is wonderful. And then you leave the theater and you think, no, actually, it's not wonderful. I mean, if you've ever been by the bedside of a loved one and seen them die or heard the news of someone ill, sick, dying, you think, you know what? There's something within me that says this is not natural, and yet our world wants us to believe that. It wants us to, you know what, it's just all part of it, just move on through, just pretend like everything is okay. No, Jesus, in the midst of suffering, your suffering, weeps. The language here in the original text, which is in Greek, speaks of him roaring like that of a lion about to go into battle. And that's because for Jesus, death is an enemy. It's an unwelcomed foe, and he wants to defeat it. Jesus came to defeat death, not dance with death, but defeat it. And that leads to the second observation, which I want you to take note of, that Jesus is the one who is not only moved by our suffering, he's able to deal with our suffering. The Bible reveals, and I hope you've seen this throughout this week and with the various lectures, that we were made for life. We were made to live. We were made to enjoy friendship and family, made to enjoy the wonderful creation that we have here, made to enjoy God. We were made to enjoy God, made to enjoy life for forever. We were made to enjoy it, to know it. And yet, in our foolishness, we ran from God. We thought that we could create a life that would be better for us without God. We said no to God, and yet when we said no to God, we said no to his life. We said no to his love. And we chose for ourselves death. We chose for ourselves death, and death entered into this world. And God said, I'm not going to turn my back on these people. I'm not going to give up on you. Though you have longed for death, I long for life, and I'm going to come to bring you that life. And he came to bring us that life in Jesus. I grew up thinking that Jesus was nothing more than a swear word. Didn't go to church until I was about 16 years of age. To me, Jesus was just a swear word. I met other people who thought of Jesus as just a good moral teacher. I met others who thought of Jesus as a bit of a spiritual guide. All of those categories or pictures of Jesus fall short of who he really is. Jesus is the God made flesh, the God man, who came to bring us home to God, to bring us life. And this story is a picture, a historical event, yes, but a picture of his power over death. He wants everybody around, he wants us here today to see that he and he alone is able to overcome death. And what's interesting is that after this text, which is not written out here, but in the next little section, you'll see that after his miracle, after this healing, the religious people didn't celebrate this victory over death. They conspired against him. They said, this guy's looking too much like God. We don't want him in our life. We don't like this. This rocks our religious structures and our power. We need to get rid of Jesus. And so they killed Jesus. And Jesus was nailed to a Roman cross. In that moment, they thought they had victory. And yet, as Christians, we know that something profound was going on in that moment. You see, the death that we chose is the death that we now deserve. Here on the cross, Jesus was paying the price for that. He was putting himself forward as a substitute for our death, for the payment that we deserve, for all our rebellion and rejection of God. He was taking it upon himself. He was our substitute. And though everyone looked at Jesus on the cross and they mocked him and ridiculed him and thought death had had the final word, history reveals, the scripture reveals, that 3 days after his execution, Jesus himself rose to new life. Jesus himself rose to new life. Jesus is the one who is life. He demonstrates it with Lazarus. He demonstrates it in his own life, that you and I would know that there is one, and in one we can find life, and that is Jesus. He's able to deal with our suffering. He's able to give us life here and now, and indeed for the future. And this leads to the third and final point. In Jesus, we will all see and experience an end to suffering. Let me say that again. In Jesus, we all will see and experience an end to suffering. This miracle, and it is a miracle, of Jesus raising Lazarus from the grave, is both a demonstration of his power over evil, his power over death, but a sign pointing us forward to a future reality. He's saying, he's showing us that it is possible, and there will be a day where those in him will have the clothes of death that have held us back exchanged for the clothes of life. That whatever suffering we are in right now will be made good in him. The death will not have the final word, Jesus will. And when Jesus speaks, he speaks life. Jesus speaks life. This time last week, I was in a cafe with a young woman at our church, late 20s, sharing about her younger brother. She'd written a book about her younger brother. Her brother was diagnosed with leukemia, and her brother died age 17. Gripping story. I couldn't help but weep just hearing her talk about it. As I'm reading her book, hearing her journey through what it means to be a Christian in the midst of such suffering, I was reminded again of the great hope we have in Jesus. And the second last page, she includes this quote which comes from the Bible, book of Revelations. And Revelations, if you're not familiar with Scripture, is a picture of what is to come. You see, Jesus not only knows the present story, he knows the future story. And in his grace and his love, he's not sought to leave us in the dark. He's given us a revelation, a picture of what is to come for those who are in him. And this is a snippet of that picture, a window. This is what you said. This is from Revelation. I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God." And note this, he will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. I want you to picture that. Imagine that. A world where we will be with God. We will see him, know him, experience him face to face. And he will wipe every tear from our eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying, for the old order of things has passed away. It's important that we acknowledge that we are right now in the old order of things. This is not heaven. There are better days to come. There will in this life be suffering and tragedy and brokenness. But Jesus promises for those that are in him a new world, a new kingdom, a new heaven, a new earth in which death will be defeated. Death will be no more. Suffering will be no more. New life. You long for that. You set your eyes for that. I believe our bodies ache for that. It's because God is telling us that that's ultimately where home is. Our existence here and now is short, fleeting. It will come and it will go. God has for you an eternal home. We can rejoice in that. We can be thankful for that. And Jesus then leaves us, and I'll leave you with this question. Remember what he said? He says this. He says, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" The difference between your life now and for eternity comes down to what Jesus has done for us and our response to him in belief. We don't buy our way into a coming kingdom. We don't earn our way in with religious acts of worship or ritual or being raised in the right family. You know, perhaps like me, you've lived a life completely outside of the church. Perhaps like me, you did a whole bunch of stuff that you totally regret before God. I've sinned before God in so many ways. And yet here is good news from Jesus. Jesus was prepared to die for my sin, rise for my life. He says, "Do you believe? Do you trust me?" That's what Jesus is looking for. You say, "Well, I want to be a Christian. I want to know of this coming kingdom. I want to walk and see God." Do you believe in Jesus? Not have you been a perfect moral person. Not did you, were you raised in the right religious school. No, do you believe in Jesus? If you're a Christian here, Jesus has great news for you. There is a coming kingdom. If you've given your life to Jesus, if you know this Jesus, then rejoice. Be thankful in that. Be thankful in that. If you're not yet a Christian, if you've not yet given your life to Jesus, then I want to encourage you to respond. To respond in faith to him. I first gave my life to Jesus when I was 16 years of age. It was the best decision I ever made. It's not to say that things became easy from that point. Still challenges. But I know I now have a Savior who is walking with me every step of the way. I seek to follow him, and I know that I have a future secured in him. The way I began my journey of following Jesus was with a prayer. I'm going to read you the kind of prayer that I prayed and then give you an opportunity to pray this prayer with me. I'll read it first and I want you to reflect. Is this a prayer that you could pray? I'll read it out to you. Dear Lord, I thank you for Jesus. I believe in Jesus, that he is the resurrection and the life. I thank you that he came into the world to bring life. I thank you that he died on a cross in my place that I might live. Lord, I've done many things that don't please you. I've lived my life for myself. I'm sorry and I turn to you. I ask you to forgive me, and here and now I accept your grace. I accept your mercy. Thank you that you rose to new life and the promise that you will be with me now and in the age to come. I ask now that you lead and guide me, direct me by your Spirit, and help me to follow you each and every day. I'm going to pray that prayer again and invite everyone here to pray that prayer with me with our eyes closed as we kind of reflect on that. And as I do it, I'm going to pause at every line and give you an opportunity to echo this prayer in your heart and in your head. And if a Christian here, then it's an opportunity for you to reaffirm your faith and your confidence in Jesus. And if not, if you're not yet a Christian, this is an opportunity for you to say, you know what? From here on in, I'm going to be for Jesus. I'm going to live for Jesus. I'm going to enjoy the life that he has for me. I'll give you a moment to reflect, to close your eyes, and then I'll read this out. Dear Lord, I thank you for Jesus. I believe that Jesus is the resurrection and the life. I thank you that he came in the world, in this world, to bring life. I thank you that he died on a cross in my place that I might live. Lord, I've done many things that don't please you. I've lived my life for myself. I'm sorry, and I turn to you. I ask you to forgive me. And here and now, I accept your grace. Thank you that you rose to new life. And the promise that you will be with me now and in the age to come. And I ask now that you lead and guide me. Direct me by your Spirit. And help me to follow you each and every day. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.